Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
Alrighty then. Today is Tuesday, the 11th of July, in the glorious future year of 2023, and I am getting ready, as I've said, to head to Canada. And most of the time I'm in Canada, I'll either be at the beach, where there's no internet service, or I'll be at the North American Science Fiction Convention, where I'll be busy doing other things. But I was thinking I might be able to use this dial-in, particularly to do Saturday shows on, let's see, what days? Let's see, the 15th, obviously, the 29th, and the 5th. The 22nd still being up in the air. I'll be at the convention then, and I may or may not find it convenient to dial in then. Otherwise, I think this time slot is mostly going to be reruns. Okay. Because I'm, you know, the likelihood is if I'm going to be calling in, it's probably going to be from the community center at Grand Beach, not from my friend's phone, which doesn't have cheap calls into the U.S. He's got a sort of emergency backup mobile phone. I'm not bothering to get a mobile phone for use in Canada. Why would I? I don't carry one at home either. Anyway, so what was I about? So that gives you an idea of what my sort of plans are for the next little while. If none of that works, then the next time you'll hear from me is liable to be Friday the 11th in this time slot. Okay. All right. So that's the that's basically the story. And let's see. Speaking of stories, you know, the Wall Street Journal the other way. The Wall Street Journal the other day had a full page front cover dedicated to one of their colleagues who's been detained in Russia now for 100 days. And I'm just thinking, this is amazing. I'm seeing the Wall Street Journal do this whole big song and dance about, you know, journalistic independence and integrity and how important it is. Guys, you work for Rupert Murdoch. You know, the editorial line of your paper is very firmly, you know, forget what happened to Jamal Khashoggi. Yeah, it's unfortunate, but we really need that special relationship with Saudi Arabia. You know. the Wall Street Journal continues to baffle me. Anyway, last time I was reading this Origin of the Elements and Stars by Hoyle, Fowler, Burbage, and Burbage from 1956. And I got down to the end of the section entitled Neutrons. These considerations are perhaps made clearer by Figure 1, which has been produced after the matter of Seuss and Urey. I may try to scan it. And shows their abundance data in the region from atomic weight 120 to 150. In this figure, nuclear species produced in the same process are connected by shaded curves, and the general trend of the production by the three processes becomes clear. The magic number peaks, noted by Susanduri and by Coriel, stand out clearly in both the odd A and even A nuclei. Tin says, Rupert Murdoch is known for imprisoning journalists? Man, work conditions at the Wall Street Journal must be terrible. Well, I don't know that he's known for imprisoning journalists, but his attitude towards journalistic and integrity and independence could perhaps be described with a loud guffaw. You know, in China, his newspapers proudly support and say everything possible good about the Chinese Communist Party. In America, they say everything possible good about the, you know, right-wing political parties and so on. It's all who he thinks will give him money and power. And what's actually happening in the world is a very, very far back consideration. There's not that much. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that other journalistic outlets are perfect. I'm just saying that in the case of Murdoch's media, the contrast is particularly bad, especially because he controls so many outlets in so many markets. Okay, let's see. So, yeah, here's section. Next section is capture of protons and photodisintegrations. Just as adulteration of the hydrogen of a star by elements up to iron 56 is to be expected, so adulteration of the hydrogen by the heavier elements that are built in the R and S processes is to be expected. Such adulteration leads to an interesting additional effect when hydrogen remains unconsumed in the outer regions of a supernova, as it probably does in the case of type 1 supernovae. In a former paper, reasons were given for the generation of temperatures of approximately 2.5 times 10 to the 9th power degrees in this hydrogen. At such temperatures, proton gamma reactions, that's proton capture of a proton with emission of a gamma ray, proton gamma reactions occur in a time of the order of 10 seconds, even on the heaviest nuclei, P process. It seems that the proton-rich isotopes of the heavy elements were built in this fashion. These isotopes are characterized by the important property that they cannot be built directly by either the R or S process, and that their abundances bear an approximately constant ratio of 10 to the minus second power to that of those neighboring isotopes that are built by the R and S processes. The low value of this ratio, together with its approximate constancy from atomic weight of approximately 70 up to approximately 200, is satisfactorily explained by a process in which a few protons are added at high temperatures to the products of R and S processes. The number of protons that can be added is independent of atomic weight when the energy is large enough that barrier effects are not important at the higher values of atomic weight. This is because proton instability sets in at the same proton excess, approximately 10, relative to the stable nuclei, independently of atomic weight. The proton-rich isotopes may also be explained by gamma neutron and gamma proton reactions at high temperature operating on the products of the R and S processes. Those are reactions in which the gamma rays hit a nucleus and expel a neutron or a proton. General conclusions. The trends of the three processes can be mapped throughout the heavy element region, and there is reason to believe that the abundance curves will be amenable to quantitative treatment in terms of beta decay rates and of the cross-sections for the neutron and proton capture processes. In the past, this has not been possible, for it was not realized that the abundance curve represented a superposition of contributions from several processes. The magic number peaks in the S process and their shifted counterparts in the R process are not as pronounced in the overall abundance curve as they are in the contributing curves. It is already clear that both the slow and rapid neutron capture processes operated under conditions of steady streaming. For instance, in the case of the S process, it appears that the products obtained by multiplying the abundances built through the S process by the appropriate neutron gamma cross-sections of the stable nuclei are remarkably constant from isotope to isotope, as would be expected on the basis of steady streaming. There is one notable discrepancy in the case of the element lead. neutron capture processes should terminate in a cycling among the lead isotopes at the onset of alpha activity. If steady streaming has occurred, there should be a consequent building up of the abundance of lead, and we find that the abundance, as given by Seuss and Urey, is too low by a factor of approximately 10 to 10 to the second to be consistent with this. A consideration of the building of the transuranic elements by the R process has enabled us to estimate the number of progenitors of uranium-235 and of U-238. Uranium-235 results from the alpha decay, which follows the beta decay of the neutron-rich nuclei produced with A equals 235, 239, 243, 247, 251, and 255. Beyond A equals 259, the ultimate decay is probably by spontaneous fission rather than by alpha emission. Uranium-235 results from production at A equals... No, it means uranium-238. That's a typographical error. Uranium-238 results from production at A equals 238, 242, 246, and 250. Thus, U-235 has 6 odd-A progenitors, while U-238 has 4 even-A progenitors. Odd-even pairing energy effects become progressively less important throughout the heavy stable nuclei, and we would expect neutron capture cross-sections to be very nearly equal for odd-A and even-A elements in the heaviest nuclei. This must indeed be the case in the rapid neutron capture peak near A equals 194, similar to the peak at A equals 130 in Figure 1, where the abundances of odd-A, even-A are nearly equal. For example, platinum-195 to platinum-194 ratio is 1.03. Thus, it appears that the production ratio, U-235 over U-238, was probably about 1.5, and in any case was unlikely to be less than unity. If we suppose that the elements of which the Earth is composed were not all built at one moment of time, but were built at a uniform rate, starting at the time of origin of the galaxy and extending almost up to the formation of the solar system some 5 × 10⁹ years ago, then, using the ratio of the uranium isotopes found at present in the Earth, the age of the galaxy can be calculated. For the case of a production ratio of U-235 over U-238 equal to unity, the age is 7.5 × 10⁹ years. While a still greater age is obtained if a production of ratio of 1.5 is used for U-235 relative to U-238. The argument for this high value can be restated as follows. At the time of the formation of the solar system, we can calculate that the ratio U-238 over U-235 equals 3.5. On the basis of production, either in a single event or continuously, an additional time interval is required to reach the time at which U-238 over U-235 roughly equals unity. Finally, it may be remarked that, since the production of the heavy elements, A greater than 60, is a byproduct of ordinary thermal cooking that depends on the adulteration of the hydrogen out of which a star forms, it is to be expected that these elements will be synthesized in abundances that are very low compared with the ordinary products of thermal cooking. For example, oxygen-16, silicon-28, and iron-56. This is precisely the case. In the references and notes, there's one note of any significance. A detailed quantitative account of this work is in preparation. The work was supported in part by the joint program of the Office of Naval Research and the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. We wish to take this opportunity to thank Stanley Thompson and Rosemary Barrett of the University of California, Berkeley, for helpful discussions of material to be published on the properties of the transuranium nuclei, including californium-254. Now, here's the thing that doesn't seem to be noted in this paper, which is somewhat confusing. Under the heading of neutrons, he discusses the building of californium-254 in a process of very rapid neutron addition. The 55-day spontaneous fission decay of californium-254 is the source of energy dominating the light emission of the supernovae after maximum. Now, the implication here is that a supernova may form many times the mass of the Earth in californium-254, which then decays by spontaneous fission with a 55-day half-life. This is very interesting because it implies large numbers, or large masses, we should say, of fission products, which he has not accounted for. there are several more papers in this collection. I'll start with the shorter ones, really. Let's see. Just flipping backwards. I'm going in reverse order through this volume for some reason. But let's see. Reprinted from Astronomical Journal, 1952, University of Chicago. Nuclear reactions in stars without hydrogen. This work was carried out during the summer of 1951 at the Kellogg Radiation Laboratory, California Institute of Technology, Pasadena. The author is indebted to several colleagues at the California Institute of Technology and at the Mount Wilson and Palomar Observatories for valuable discussions. Okay. Let's see. Do I have, is this? Okay. Nuclear reactions in stars without hydrogen, E.E. Saltpeter. The more luminous main sequence stars, O and B, exhaust their hydrogen supply in times of the order of magnitude of 10 to the 9th power years or less, the bulk of the hydrogen being converted into helium by means of the carbon-nitrogen cycle. When the energy supply of the carbon-nitrogen cycle has been exhausted, the star undergoes gravitational contraction and its temperature increases. Various nuclear processes have been suggested for such a contracting star, all of which require temperatures of well over 10 to the 9th power degrees Kelvin. The main aim of this note is to point out that there is one nuclear process which takes place at a much lower temperature of about 2 times 10 to the 8th power Kelvin, namely the conversion of 3 helium nuclei into 1 carbon nucleus, which, of course, was the great work of Fred Hoyle in his doctoral thesis, dissertation. We take as an example a main sequence star of mass 5 times that of the Sun, a B8 star. Central density, rho, equals 25 grams per cubic centimeter, and central temperature, T, capital T, equals 2 times 10 to the 7th power Kelvin. The average energy radiated by the star, epsilon with over bar, is about 60 ergs per gram and per second, and most of the hydrogen is exhausted in about 10 to the 9th power years. We assume that in the ensuing gravitational contraction, the central temperature and density are given by T proportional to R to the minus 1, rho proportional to R to the minus 3, where R is the radius of the star. Gravitational energy is the only source of energy during the contraction until temperatures of over 10 to the 9th power Kelvin, 10 to the 8th power Kelvin, are reached in a few million years. At these temperatures, the following nuclear reaction sets in. Helium-4 plus helium-4 plus 95 keV going to beryllium-8 plus gamma, helium-4 plus beryllium-8 going to carbon-12 plus gamma, 7.4 million electron volts. The nucleus, beryllium-8, is unstable to disintegration into 2 helium-4 nuclei with a time scale of microseconds or less. But since an energy of only 95 plus or minus 5 kiloelectron volts, comparable with thermal energies at temperatures over 10 to the 8th power Kelvin, is required for its formation, a fraction of about 1 in 10 to the 10th power of the material of the star is kept in the form of beryllium-8 in a state of dynamic equilibrium. The beryllium-8 present then easily absorbs a helium nucleus. Once carbon has been produced, the following reactions also become possible. Carbon-12 plus helium-4, oxygen-16 plus 7.1 million electron volts, oxygen-16 plus helium-4, neon-20 plus 4.7 mega electron volt gamma. And so on. Owing to the increasing Coulomb barrier, the reaction rates decrease with increasing atomic number. Assuming the absence of gamma ray resonances, the rates for reactions 2 and 3b are of the same order of magnitude, where 2 is the production of carbon-12 from beryllium-8, and 3b is the production of neon-20. Hence, the helium is probably converted mainly into carbon-12, oxygen-16, and neon-20, and into decreasing amounts of magnesium-24, silicon-28, sulfur-32, argon-36, and calcium-40. Energies of 3 to 4 million electron volts per helium nucleus are produced in these reactions, about 1/7 the production in the carbon-nitrogen cycle. At temperatures T in the neighborhood of 2 times 10 to the 8th power Kelvin, the rate of energy production epsilon is given by epsilon equals 10 to the 3rd power times in parentheses, rho over 2.5 times 10 to the 4th power squared times, in parentheses, T over 2 times 10 to the 8th power kelvins to all quantity to the 18th power, x sub a cubed erg per gram centimeter per gram second, where rho is the density in gram per cubic centimeter, and x sub a is the concentration by weight of helium. No detailed calculations have as yet been carried out with specific stellar models, but a temperature of slightly more times than 10 to 2 times 10 to the 8th power Kelvin should be sufficient for the energy generation 4 to supply the rate of energy loss. In deriving equation 4, the nuclear gamma ray width for the formation of carbon-12, but not the one for beryllium-8, is required. This width has not yet been measured, and the position of resonance levels is not yet known accurately enough, and an estimate of 0.1 electron volt was used for this width. Hence, the correct production rate could be smaller than equation 4 by a factor of as much as 10, or larger than equation 4 by as much as 1,000. However, even a factor of 1,000 in the production rate alters the temperature necessary by a factor of only 1.33. If we assume an average radiative energy loss of about 200 ergs per gram second, the energy content of reactions 2 and 3 is sufficient to maintain the star at an almost constant temperature and radius, central density rho about 2.5 times 10 to the 4th power grams per cubic centimeter for about 5 times 10 to the 7th power years, after which time the bulk of the helium will have been converted into carbon and heavier nuclei. We are thus led to the conclusion that a few percent of all visible stars of mass 5 solar masses or greater are converting helium into heavier nuclei, the central temperatures being about 10 times larger and radius 10 times smaller than that of a main sequence star of the same mass. It is hoped that some connection will be found between stars undergoing this process, on the one hand, and carbon-rich and high-temperature stars, Wolf-Rayet nuclei of planetary nebulae, on the other, and possibly even with some of the variable stars and novae. The fate of stars which have exhausted their helium supply and consist mainly of carbon, oxygen, and neon is much more controversial, but some tentative qualitative conclusions can be drawn about the various competing nuclear reactions. The star again contracts gravitationally until temperatures of about 10 to the 9th power kelvins are reached. At these temperatures, collisions between two carbon-12 nuclei giving magnesium-24 or sodium-23 plus proton become possible, and at slightly higher temperatures, collisions involving oxygen-16 and neon-20. At temperatures of 2 to 4 times 10 to the 9th power Kelvin, the dissociation of the lighter nuclei into helium nuclei and into protons becomes important. These helium nuclei and protons can be absorbed by heavier nuclei, with the result that a significant fraction of the nuclei in the star might be converted into a variety of different nuclei of atomic weight, A, up to about 40 or 60. The relative concentrations of the various nuclear species might be expected to be similar to that obtained on Hoyle's theory of thermodynamic equilibrium. At 1 to 4 times 10 to the 9th power kelvins, however, the Urca processes of Gamow and Schoenberg become important, which extract energy from a star in the form of escaping neutrinos. This energy loss results in a very rapid contraction of the star without any increase in temperature, as soon as the energy supply from the conversion into the very stable nuclei, A, about 40 to 60, is exhausted. This contraction continues, unless the star becomes unstable because of its rotational momentum, until densities of more than 10 times 10 to the 10th power grams per cubic centimeter are reached. The electron gas is then highly degenerated, and fairly large concentrations of beta-active nuclei are built up because of the high kinetic energies of the degenerate electron gas. What a phrase! Degenerate electron gas. More detailed calculations will be necessary to determine whether enough time is available during this collapse to build up the very heavy nuclei up to uranium, as was suggested by Hoyle. If the star becomes unstable during the collapse and becomes a supernova, one would expect the various beta-active nuclei to be expelled and to decay in the envelope of the supernova. These considerations lead to difficulties for Borst's hypothesis that the energy generation in envelopes of supernovae of type 1 is due to a large extent to the beta decay of one single nucleus, beryllium-7, obtained from the reaction helium-4 plus helium-4 gives beryllium-7 plus neutron. It may, however, be possible that this reaction predominates over the others discussed in this note if, in a supernova of type 1, convection sets in suddenly, with velocities comparable to those of freefall, so that helium-4 from the cooler outer layers of the star is suddenly brought into the central regions at a temperature of about 4 times 10 to the 9th power Kelvin. It should be emphasized again that the remarks in this paragraph are quite tentative and speculative. A fuller account of the calculations and the various processes discussed in this note will be given elsewhere. Well, it might be said at this point that the one great contribution of the invention of the hydrogen bomb to science was the explication of the mechanism of supernovae, specifically of the rebound of that collapsing material. So let's see. Here's a good one. P.J.E. Peebles, Palmer Physical Laboratory, Princeton University, Princeton, New Jersey, received 7th February 1966. This is from Physical Review Letters. Primeval helium abundance and the primeval fireball. We now have a second point on the spectrum of the microwave background, and it is consistent with the idea that this is blackbody radiation, the primordial fireball left over from the Big Bang. If this is confirmed by further observations at shorter wavelengths, we will have learned the present temperature of the universe, and we will be able to trace back from this temperature to find something about the history of the universe. At an early stage in the expansion of the universe, thermal reactions would have produced deuterium and helium. This is the old Big Bang theory of the formation of the elements. The purpose of this note is to present the results of a recent calculation of the primeval element abundances issuing from the Big Bang. These depend on two observable quantities, the temperature of the fireball radiation and the mean mass density in the universe. The abundances are high enough that an observational test appears quite possible. The details of the calculation will be described elsewhere. The computed helium and deuterium abundances are shown in Figure 1. The best estimate for the mean mass density in the universe would be in the range 7 times 10 to the minus 31 power grams per cubic centimeter, the estimated mass in galaxies, to 2 times 10 to the minus 29th power grams per cubic centimeter, the mass density required to close the universe. For this density range, if the present temperature of the fireball is 3 kelvins, the computed primeval helium abundance is 27 to 30% by mass. If the average mass density in the universe were a factor of 30 below the accepted estimate of the mass in galaxies, it would lead to a much lower primeval helium abundance. Now, I have to pause here and explain that this method of estimating the mass of the universe in relation to the abundance of helium in the universe, and particularly of deuterium in the universe, is the main consideration which gives rise to theories of so-called dark matter. Because the estimates are at variance. We can estimate the amount of mass in galaxies from the velocity of their rotation, and it seems that they contain a lot more mass than is present in stars. But if they contain that much more mass, the deuterium abundance of the universe should be much different. And so it's hypothesized that there's a lot of mass in galactic halos, which is somehow does not interact electromagnetically, is not composed of baryonic matter, and therefore the deuterium abundance isn't relevant to it. But then you get the so-called dark energy because the galaxies are moving away from each other faster than they should if the estimate of the mass is correct. It's all a puzzlement. It would be very interesting to compare the helium abundances in Figure 1 with the composition of the oldest stars in our galaxy, but at present very little is known about the helium abundance in these stars. From the composition of solar cosmic rays and spectroscopic heavy element abundances, and from solar models, the helium abundance in the Sun is thought to be about 25% by mass, and abundance as high as 30% would not be excluded. An important question here is whether the solar helium abundance could be accounted for by production in earlier generations of stars. It has been emphasized that the present rate of hydrogen burning in the galaxy is not enough to produce this much helium over the lifetime of the galaxy, possibly indicating a high primordial helium abundance. Also, the rapidly evolving mass of stars, which would have produced the elements in the solar system, actually may produce less helium than heavier elements, implying a helium production less than the heavy element abundance, roughly 2% by mass. On the other hand, we know from the rapid increase of heavy elements through the population 2 stars that the early galaxy was much more active than it is now, and stellar evolution theory is not well enough established to exclude a high rate of helium production in massive stars in the young galaxy. The high initial helium abundance required by the theory therefore remains quite possible, but it appears that a definite test of the theory must await improved observational evidence. As all scientists everywhere say. The deuterium abundance shown in Figure 1 can exceed the upper limit on the abundance of interstellar deuterium, but deuterium would have been burned out of the hydrogen in the cycling of material through stars. Since we thus can imagine deuterium being produced or destroyed in the galaxy, with the present state of knowledge, the deuterium abundance cannot provide a very clear test either for or against the theory. The computed helium-3-helium-4 abundance ratio is somewhat less than the abundance ratio found in primordial gas and meteorites, so apparently it should be assumed that some helium-3 was produced in the galaxy. There appear to be no reactions capable of producing appreciable amounts of elements heavier than helium. I suppose he means the primordial fireball. The abundances in Figure 1 were obtained with two basic assumptions: that general relativity is valid, and that the universe may be treated as homogeneous and isotropic. It has been pointed out that if we relaxed the condition of isotropy and allowed a homogeneous shear motion, the expansion time scale in the early universe could be decreased almost at will. This is an important point, but there is a general difficulty with the idea that the early universe may have been highly anisotropic or irregular. We know from galaxy counts and redshift observations that the universe is in the large homogeneous and isotropic about us to a redshift of perhaps z equals 0.2. Assuming that the new microwave background is the primordial fireball, we have also a measure of isotropy at a much larger distance. If the early universe were highly anisotropic, it would require a very special choice of the free parameters of the solution to assume a nearly isotropic universe now. Given the freedom of starting with a highly anisotropic universe, it is difficult to believe that these parameters would have been just such as to present us now with an isotropic universe. More generally, if we introduced any appreciable perturbation to the expansion timescale or density distribution in the early universe, we must expect that the perturbations would only grow worse with time. There do exist solutions in which the perturbations grow smaller, but just as in conventional perturbation problems, we would never expect to observe a decaying perturbation when a growing perturbation exists, because it would require so very special initial conditions. Element production in the Big Bang is based on the idea that if we can trace the expansion of the universe back to a temperature well above 10 to the 10th power Kelvin, 1 million electron volts, we find that the thermal pair production reactions flood space with electron and neutrino pairs, and these leptons react with nucleons, the most important reactions being proton plus electron giving neutron plus neutrino, and proton plus antineutrino giving neutron plus positron, anti-electron. The resulting neutron abundance was first computed in detail by Alpher, Fallon, and Hermann. The neutrons can react with protons to form deuterium, but photodissociation keeps the abundance very low until the temperature has dropped to about 10 to the 9th power Kelvin. The amount of element formation thus depends on the nucleon density in the universe when the temperature has dropped to 10 to the 9th power Kelvin. On the plateau at the left-hand side of the helium abundance curve in Figure 1, almost all the neutrons, which survive to the time nuclear burning becomes possible, react to form deuterium, which burns to helium. The helium abundance increases slowly with decreasing temperature because fewer neutrons decay before nuclear reactions commence. For a high primordial fireball temperature, the nucleon density would be low when nuclear burning could begin, so little deuterium or helium would be produced. The deuterium abundance is maximum at the shoulder of the helium curve. In a hotter universe, little deuterium is produced, and in a colder universe, a good deal of deuterium is produced, but most of it burns to helium. The rate of expansion of the universe depends on the energy density and pressure of the electromagnetic radiation, electron pairs, and the two kinds of neutrinos. It may be assumed that these are all in thermal equilibrium in the early universe, but when the electron pairs recombine at 10 to the 10th power Kelvin, the energy goes into radiation, and the radiation temperature ends up higher than the neutrino temperature by the factor of 11 over 4 to the power of 1/3. The reaction rates for reactions 1 and 2 were obtained from the VA theory, neglecting electromagnetic corrections, and the coupling constants taken from a recent review. The footnote there is to G. Kalin, Elementary Particle Physics, Edison-Wesley, 1964. The electron density was computed using the free particle approximation. The half-life for neutron decay was taken to be 11.7 minutes, with no correction for partial degeneracy of the electrons and neutrinos, because by the time any appreciable number of neutrons can decay, the partial degeneracy extends to an energy well less than the energy decay. Well less than the decay energy. For the same reason, we can neglect the three-body reaction, which is the reverse of neutron decay. From a numerical integration, taking account of equations 1, 2, and neutron decay, the neutron abundance was found to be consistent within 5% with the previous calculation of alpha, Fallon, and Hermann. The important nuclear reactions are neutron plus proton, deuterium, giving deuterium plus gamma, deuterium plus deuterium giving helium 3 plus neutron, deuterium plus deuterium giving tritium plus proton, helium 3 plus neutron giving tritium plus proton, and tritium plus deuterium giving helium 4 plus neutron. There are many other possible reactions, but for conditions of interest, none would appreciably affect the final deuterium abundance. Interesting, because I always think, of course, of helium 3 plus deuterium giving helium 4 plus proton as being important to the final deuterium. In some cases, the helium 3 abundance would be lowered if we took account of other helium 3 burning reactions. With regard to the helium 4 abundance, we know quite generally that it is a question of how completely the nuclei can relax to thermal equilibrium. The introduction of any new nuclear reactions could only increase the relaxation rate, and so increase the final abundance of helium or heavier elements. The experimentally determined reaction cross-sections were fitted to simple formulas. The cross-section taken to be inversely proportional to velocity for the neutron capture reactions, and a formula of the Gamow type assumed for the charged particle reactions, and the results numerically integrated against a Maxwell velocity distribution to obtain the reaction rates. The six differential equations for the abundances, taking account of reactions 1 and 2, neutron decay, the above-mentioned nuclear reactions, and the reverse of each of these reactions, were numerically integrated from an initial temperature of 10 to the 12th power Kelvin through the completion of nuclear burning. The results of a typical integration are shown in Figure 2. Abundance of the elements versus time assumed that the primordial fireball radiation temperature is 3.5 kelvins. The present mean mass density of the universe is 7 times 10 to the minus 31st power grams per cubic centimeter. If the universe contains gravitational radiation, or perhaps a new kind of neutrino field, the time scale for expansion is reduced. This increases the neutron abundance coming out of the Big Bang,
and so raises the level of the plateau on the left-hand side of the helium abundance curve in Figure 1. Gee, I wonder if the recent discovery of neutrino oscillation would affect that. If we introduce new radiation energy density equivalent to a new kind of two-component neutrino field, the resulting helium abundance by mass is increased from 0.30 to 0.32. The additional radiation also moves the shoulder of the curve to the left, the radiation temperature at the shoulder varying inversely as the sixth root of the total energy density in the form of primordial radiation and neutrinos. Assuming that the nucleon mass density is now at least 7 times 10 to the minus 31st gram per cubic centimeter, with the addition of an amount of radiation consistent with the limits implied by the acceleration parameter, the first effect is more important, and the primeval helium abundance is increased. For a reasonable value of the mean mass density in the universe, we have concluded that the theory requires a large primeval helium abundance, and if this agrees with observation, it must be considered a remarkably stringent test of general relativity. On the other hand, if the primeval helium abundance is found to be low, and the presence of a 3 Kelvin primordial fireball confirmed, we believe that the result will be difficult to explain on the basis of conventional general relativity. It is a pleasure to acknowledge fruitful discussion of this problem with R.H. Dickey, D.T. Wilkinson, P.G. Roll, and R.J. Taylor. User 724 says, anyone here want to hear about how dumb I am? For reasons distantly related to Netflix, I bought a teleprinter. Okay, that's a bad first step for sure. I decided the sensible thing to do was use Bittleby to interface it to Google Chat. Problem was every IRC client I used caused Bittleby to spit out the entire chat history, obviously problematic on a teletype. I eventually settled on using II and a homebrew front-end from someone on this site as a workabout. Neff interjects, you'd probably be better off using something like IRCII. Neff says, IIRC, if I recall correctly, I believe that is more line-generated, line-oriented than most. User 724 continues, that printed the chat history. But anyway, I was looking for something better when it occurred to me, why not just go into Google Chat and clear the history? So I did that, and now IRCII in dumb mode works fine. Here's a paper, Cosmological Abundances of the Nuclei, which depends on some really complicated graphs. Pretty cool, though. But showing the interrelation between boron 8, beryllium 8, beryllium 7, lithium 7, helium 4, helium 3, deuterium, tritium, neutrons, and protons. The exergic directions are indicated, although rates are often rapid in both directions. The other incoming and outgoing particles, those not shown in squares, are indicated in parentheses. Dashed arrows indicate the weak interactions. There are sometimes competing reactions leading from one nucleus to another. I might, however, instead start reading Hans Bethe's 1938 paper, Energy Production in Stars, which is much less dependent on diagrams. It is shown that the most important source of energy, this is italicized, the most important source of energy in ordinary stars is the reaction of carbon and nitrogen with protons. These reactions form a cycle in which the original nucleus is reproduced, viz., carbon 12 plus hydrogen to nitrogen 13, nitrogen 13 to carbon 12 plus positron, carbon 12 plus hydrogen to nitrogen, carbon 13 rather, plus positron, carbon 13 plus hydrogen to nitrogen 14, nitrogen 14 plus hydrogen to oxygen 15, oxygen 15 to nitrogen 15 plus positron, nitrogen 15 plus hydrogen to carbon 12 plus helium 4, not to oxygen 16, which is what you'd expect because of the large excess energy due to the very great stability of oxygen-16. Thus, carbon and nitrogen serve merely as catalysts for the combination of four protons and two electrons into an alpha particle. The carbon-nitrogen reactions are unique in their cyclical character. For all nuclei lighter than carbon, reaction with protons will lead to the emission of an alpha particle so that the original nucleus is permanently destroyed. For all nuclei heavier than fluorine, only radiative capture of the protons occurs, also destroying the original nucleus. Oxygen and fluorine reactions mostly lead back to nitrogen. Besides, these heavier nuclei react much more slowly than carbon and nitrogen and are therefore unimportant for the energy production. The agreement of the carbon-nitrogen reactions with observational data is excellent. In order to give the correct energy evolution in the Sun, the central temperature of the Sun would have to be 18.5 million degrees, while integration of the Eddington equations gives 19. For the brilliant star Y Cygni, I assume not, perhaps Upsilon Cygni, the corresponding figures are 30 and 32. This good agreement holds for all bright stars of the main sequence, but of course not for giants. For fainter stars with lower central temperatures, the reaction, hydrogen plus hydrogen to give deuterium plus positron, and the reactions following it are believed to be mainly responsible for the energy production. It is shown further that no elements heavier than helium-4 can be built up in ordinary stars. This is due to the fact, as mentioned above, that all elements up to boron are disintegrated by proton bombardment, in parentheses, alpha emission, exclamation point, rather than built up by radiative capture. The instability of beryllium-8 reduces the formation of heavier elements still farther. The production of neutrons in stars is likewise negligible. The heavier elements found in stars must therefore have existed already when the star was formed. Finally, the suggested mechanism of energy production is used to draw conclusions about astrophysical problems such as the mass-luminosity relation, the stability against temperature changes, and stellar evolution. But now, modern astrophysicists will tell you that the carbon cycle reaction is actually present in red giant stars and not in our Sun, that it produces energy much more rapidly but at a higher temperature that our Sun cannot achieve. They will also tell you, as we read in the Hoyle et al. Paper, that although beryllium-8 is unstable, in heavy stars, beryllium-8 plus helium-4 can give carbon-12. That was Fred Hoyle's great discovery. He worked out that it was possible for elements beyond helium to be produced in stars, which was previously thought impossible. Introduction. The process of nuclear physics in the last few years makes it possible to decide rather definitely which processes can and which cannot occur in the interior of stars. Such decisions will be attempted in the present paper, the discussion being restricted primarily to main sequence stars. The results will be at variance with some current hypotheses. The first main result is that, under present conditions, no elements heavier than helium can be built up to any appreciable extent. Therefore, we must assume that the heavier elements were built up before the stars reached their present state of temperature and density. No attempt will be made at speculations about this previous state of stellar matter. The energy production of stars is then due entirely to the combination of 4 protons and 2 electrons into an alpha particle. This simplifies the discussion of stellar evolution inasmuch as the amount of heavy matter, and therefore the opacity, does not change with time. This paper, by the way, was awarded the A. Cressy Morrison Prize in 1938 by the New York Academy of Sciences. The combination of 4 protons and 2 electrons can occur essentially only in 2 ways. The first mechanism starts with the combination of 2 protons to form a deuteron with positron emission, viz., H plus H giving D plus E plus. That, by the way, is understood to be the rate-limiting step because the decay of the di proton to deuteron is a very unlikely event. That over the course of billions of years with high-energy proton collisions, billions per second, right, that so has, in a star, in the core of a star, with billions of high energy proton collisions occurring per second. On average, the lifespan of a proton before it undergoes such a collision where it sticks and becomes a deuteron is billions of years. That's pretty impressive. The deuteron is then transformed into helium-4 by further capture of protons. These captures occur very rapidly compared with process 1. The second mechanism uses carbon and nitrogen as catalysts according to the chain reaction. C12 plus H to N13 plus gamma, N13 to C13 plus E plus. C13 plus H to N14 plus gamma, N14 plus H to O15 plus gamma, O15 to N15 plus positron, N15 plus H to C12 plus helium-4. The catalyst carbon-12 is reproduced in all cases except about 1 in 10,000. Therefore, the abundance of carbon and nitrogen remains practically unchanged in comparison with the change of the number of protons. The two reactions, 1 and 2, are about equally probable at a temperature of 16 times 10 to the 6th power degrees, which is close to the central temperature of the Sun, calculated at 19 times 10 to the 6th power degrees. At lower temperatures, 1 will predominate. At higher temperatures, 2. No reaction other than 1 or 2 will give an appreciable contribution to the energy production at temperatures around 20 times 10 to the 6th power degrees, such as are to be found in the interior of ordinary stars. The lighter elements, lithium, beryllium, boron, would burn in a very short time and are not replaced, as is carbon in the cycle 2, whereas the heavier elements, OF, etc., react too slowly. Helium, which is abundant, does not react with protons because the product lithium-5 does not exist. In fact, the energy evolution in stars can be used as a strong additional argument against the existence of helium-5 and lithium-5. Reaction 2 is sufficient to explain the energy production in very luminous stars of the main sequence as Y Cygni, although there are difficulties because of the quick exhaustion of the energy supply in such stars, which would occur on any theory. Neither of the reactions 1 or 2 is capable of accounting for the energy production in giants. If nuclear reactions are at all responsible for the energy production in these stars, it seems the only ones which give sufficient energy are deuterium plus hydrogen to helium-3 or lithium 6 and 7 plus proton to helium 3 and 4 plus helium 4. It seems, however, doubtful whether the energy production in giants is due to nuclear reactions at all. Again, I'm thinking that yes, this is the thing that the difficulty that Hoyle solved. We shall first calculate the energy production by nuclear reactions. Then we shall prove the impossibility of building up heavier elements under existing conditions. Next, we shall discuss the reactions available for energy production, and the results will be compared with available material on stellar temperatures and densities. Finally, we shall discuss the astrophysical problems of the mass-luminosity relation, the stability of stars against temperature changes, and stellar evolution. So, section 2 is some really ugly equations. It should be noted that generally radiative processes are rare compared with particle emission. Let's see. So instead I'm going to just read section 4, stability of unknown isotopes. For the discussion of nuclear reactions, it is essential to know whether or not certain isotopes exist, such as lithium-4, lithium-5, beryllium-6, beryllium-8, boron-8, boron-9, carbon-10, etc. The criterion for the existence of a nucleus is its energetic stability against spontaneous disintegration into heavy particles, emission of a neutron, proton, or alpha particle. Whenever a light nucleus is energetically unstable against heavy particle emission, its life will be a very small fraction of a second, usually 10 to the minus 20th power second, even if the instability is slight. Exempli gratia, beryllium-8 will have a life of 10 to the minus 13th power second if it is, by 50 kilo electron volts, heavier than 2 alpha particles. For the question of the lifetime of radioactive nuclei, it is also necessary to know the mass difference between isobars. C Similar information is required for estimating the gamma ray within capture reactions, which was a major concern of the previous section. Lithium 7 plus hydrogen to 2 helium 4 is known to be, quote, improbable, note 9, which may in fact be an error. Let's see. Well, here's an interesting footnote. PID, S.C. Kern, and V. Petrilka, Nature, 1938. The gamma rays from carbon 13 give about equally as many counts as those from carbon 12. The efficiency of the counter for carbon-13 gamma rays is about twice that for carbon-12 because the cross-section for production of Compton and Pair electrons is smaller by a factor of two-thirds, while the range of these electrons is about three times longer. With an abundance of carbon-13 of about 1%, the gamma ray width for this nucleus becomes 50 times that of carbon-12. I am indebted to Dr. Rose for these calculations. Hydrogen-3 and helium-3. The most recent determination of the reaction energy in the reaction, hydrogen 2 plus hydrogen 2 gives helium 3 plus neutron, yielded 3.29 million electron volts, as compared to 3.98 in hydrogen 2 plus hydrogen 2 giving hydrogen 3 plus hydrogen 1, tritium plus proton. With a mass difference of 0.75 million electron volts between neutron and hydrogen atom, this makes helium-3 more stable than hydrogen-3 by 0.06 million electron volts. This would be in agreement with the experimental fact that no hydrogen-3 is present in natural hydrogen to more than one part in 10 to the 12th power. Even if helium-3 should turn out to be heavier than hydrogen-3, the difference cannot be greater than about 0.05 million electron volt, 0.1 mc square, which would make the life of helium-3 exceedingly long, 2,000 years at the center of the sun, 3,000 years in the complete atom on Earth. In fact, we determined that helium-3 is approximately stable. Oh, Tina's going to the garden. You'll have fun gardening. Helium-3 is essentially stable except with respect to nuclear reactions. And hydrogen-3 tritium decays to it. Tritium, by the way, is found in natural hydrogen in surface waters of the Earth, but not in samples, say, of petroleum or what have you. Helium-4 and lithium-4. As was first pointed out by Botha and Gertner, 1936, it is definitely possible that hydrogen-4 is stable. Hydrogen-4? Jesus Christ! Lithium-4 is, of course, less stable because of the Coulomb repulsion between its three protons. Hydrogen-4, quadrium, but that's, you know, that's in The Mouse That Roared. If it is stable, lithium-4 would be formed when helium-3 captures a proton and would thus play an important role in stars. The only possible estimate of the stability seems to be a comparison of lithium-4, lithium-6 to the analogous pair boron-8, boron-9. Reasonable estimates make boron-9 just unstable, 0.3 to 0.7 million milliatomic mass units, while boron-8 comes out of the limit of stability, binding energy between minus 0.4 and plus 0.4 milliatomic mass units. That is, boron-8 about 0.3 to 0.7 millimass units more stable than boron-9. Lithium-5, see below, is unstable by 1.4 to 1.8 millimass units. If one assumes the same difference, lithium-4 is found to be unstable by approximately 1 millimass unit. However, this argument is very uncertain, and the possibility of stable lithium-4 cannot be excluded at present. Hydrogen-4 would, from a similar argument, turn out stable by 0.6 millimass unit. Thank God none of this actually exists. Helium-5 and lithium-5. The instability of helium-5 is shown directly by the experiments of Williams, Shepford, and Haxby on the reaction lithium-7 plus deuterium giving helium-5 plus helium-4.
From a measurement of the range of the alpha particles, the mass of helium at 5 is found to be 5.0137, whereas the combined mass of an alpha particle plus a neutron would be only 4.00386 plus 1.00893, 5.0128. Thus, helium-5 is unstable by 0.9 millimass units, which is far outside the experimental error of about 0.1 to 0.2 millimass units. It might be argued that the alpha particle group observed in reaction 15 might correspond to an excited state of helium-5. However, this is extremely improbable, because a nucleus of such a simple structure as helium-5 should not have any low-lying excited levels. This holds in both the alpha particle and the Hartree model of nuclear structure. Moreover, it would be difficult to explain why the alpha particle group corresponding to the ground state of helium-5 should not have been observed. Send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. And I'll get back to you when I get back from...